This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
As founder and chief executive officer of the Center for Medical Technology Policy, CMTP, and former chief medical officer at the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, Dr. Sean Tunis has worked for decades at the intersection of patient access and therapeutic value, an intersection that has grown increasingly congested due to the intense local and national debates about drug pricing in the U.S. I'm Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Dr. Tunis serves as co-editor of our Global Forum content stream for value and access and joins us today to discuss topics critical to the ongoing and sometimes contentious debate about therapeutic value and drug access in the U.S. Thank you for joining us today, Sean, and welcome.
Thanks very much for allowing me to do this.
You are the founder and chief executive officer of the Center for Medical Technology Policy. What path led you to found this organization, and specifically, what is CMTP's primary purpose, and what have been its most recent successes and perhaps challenges?
Well, we like to say that CMTP's primary purpose is to improve the quality and relevance of clinical research so that it's more informative for decision-making, with a particular emphasis on clinicians, patients, and payers. And the whole idea for setting up CMTP was triggered by some of the challenges that I was encountering in my role at the CMS in the Medicare program. One major role being the national decisions on what to pay for and what not to pay for in the Medicare program. And we tried to do those in a traditionally fairly transparent and evidence-based way. And we're often finding that the clinical research that was brought to us in support of decisions about market access and reimbursement looked more like studies that were designed for narrower circumstances, particularly for regulatory decision-making. But we often had, from a CMS perspective, we're looking for active comparators in the studies. We were looking for more patient-relevant outcomes and measured over a longer period of time. Oftentimes, we were interested in seeing different inclusion and exclusion criteria. Probably the most dramatic version being the number of studies that we saw that excluded all patients under the age of 65, which wasn't particularly useful for Medicare policymakers since the vast majority of Medicare patients are over the age of 65. So we thought it would be useful to set up an organization where we could talk with CMS and other payers and get them to identify what they'd like to see in clinical research and make that information available to product developers so that there would be more relevant and higher quality studies available to make those market access decisions.
CMS and FDA are both regulatory agencies, or certainly parts of the federal government. Couldn't they just get together and agree on what are the optimal endpoints both for regulatory decision making and payment decision making?
In theory, they are certainly have the ability to talk and to talk about things. Kinds of things in terms of what they'd like to see in studies. So there's two main barriers to that happening. One is that there is, you know, some extreme limitations just in terms of staff bandwidth on the side of CMS. They just don't have the dozens and hundreds of people that there are at the FDA that can engage in this sort of work. So to some degree, one of the things that we think we're trying to do is to be kind of staff extenders for CMS to help engage in these sorts of discussions. Another slightly more technical issue, which is, I've written some on in the past, but it turns out that the legal statutory authority for Medicare to make coverage decisions, which comes from the original Medicare law, and it has the language about things must be reasonable and necessary in order for Medicare to pay for them. It's much like FDA's terminology of safe and effective. And because Medicare has never actually successfully completed regulations to implement the statutory language, they're not allowed to give out advice or guidance in reference to regulatory language that doesn't exist. And you can't give guidance on statutory language. So It's just a sort of a administrative barrier to CMS doing that kind of work.
Has CMTP encountered some recent successes, maybe some challenges? Let's talk about successes first. What has CMTP achieved of note?
CMTP started in almost a little over 10 years ago. So it's actually several years before the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute was developed and before there was a lot of talk about relative efficacy and real-world evidence. Those things were all very much in the areas of work that we were doing. And so I think we had an opportunity to be working early on in things like patient engagement, real-world evidence, you know, pragmatic clinical trials, coverage with evidence development, all the things that get much more airing now. And I think that we had a lot of success in bringing some of those ideas into much wider discussion. And again, all of those ideas are interconnected by having something to do with ways of conducting research that's more relevant to decision making and more efficient. I think that we, over the years, have done a lot of good work on stakeholder engagement, but particularly patient engagement. I think, you know, we didn't, you know, 5 to 7 years ago, there really wasn't a lot of understanding about how best to identify and engage with patients in ways that meaningfully changed how research was done. So there was a lot more kind of superficial interactions or just getting people to show up, but not really a lot of understanding about how to actually work with patients as partners. And I think some of the work that we did early on to around a framework for engaging patients in research was taken up by many others and certainly dramatically improved and strengthened over time. But I think we had the opportunity to get some of those ideas going in the early days. And then I guess the third area where I'd say we've had the most impact, or maybe better stated, where I think we are going to continue to have an important impact, is working on what we call effectiveness guidance documents, which are like regulatory guidance documents, but they're targeted to, you know, researchers and product developers, offering recommendations from the perspective of payers, clinicians, and patients about how to design late phase clinical trials. And those guidance documents we make available on the CMTP website. That body of work we refer to as our Green Park Collaborative. I think that work on trying to directly give these recommendations for research from a market access and reimbursement perspective to complement regulatory guidance is something that we do that's pretty unique and I think has a lot of potential in terms of helping improve clinical development strategy.
What challenges have you encountered? Are they too numerous to mention? And if so, can you just list maybe one or two major challenges you've run into?
The kind of work we do, which is very multi-stakeholder and includes, you know, all the agency representatives. Increasingly, we try to do it internationally. So, you know, involving EMA and the folks from UNETA and HTA agencies from all over the world. It's like a huge exercise in diplomacy because, you know, the stakeholders are in the room together because they each have an important perspective, but they don't necessarily easily align with one another. And so finding a way, you know, to build our skill and capabilities in just the diplomacy aspect of, you know, how do you come to some, you know, reasonable compromises that most everyone can be comfortable with in the context of methodology? It's not so simple. And then I think the other, you know, big problem, which is just kind of a operational organizational problem, which is because the work that we do is all in the public domain and we, you know, we don't hide anything behind a paywall. We have a huge problem with sort of the free rider issues or the public goods problem, which is lots of people really want to see us do the work that we're doing, but there's the incentive to actually pay for it is not great because a substantial amount of the benefits of the work being done are available to everybody, but whether they participate or not.
You mentioned the Green Park Collaborative. Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so the Green Park Collaborative is really the portfolio of projects that we do at the at CMTP that results in the development of these effectiveness guidance documents that I mentioned. And again, yes, those are just analogous to regulatory guidance. They're usually written on specific topics like drugs for type 2 diabetes, and they'd be recommendations on designing late phase trials, you know, for that drug class. and we'd go through and make recommendations on inclusion and exclusion criteria, choices of comparators, primary and secondary outcomes. But we do that through direct interaction and dialogue and working groups that include patients and all different kinds of payers and HTA experts and diabetes researchers and industry. So that's what a typical Green Park Collaborative project would be about. And where we're sort of pushing now more intensively with our Green Park Collaborative work is to really hone in on the issue of what should be the primary and secondary outcomes for late phase trials in specific therapeutic areas. And one project that's ongoing that we're really excited about, and actually there was a piece on it in I think the last issue or a couple of issues ago in the DIA Global Forum. And the project is called CoreHeme, C-O-R-E, right. And then Heme. And basically in that we're working with the National Hemophilia Foundation, the World Federation of Hemophilia, to come up with a set of agreed upon patient relevant outcomes for gene therapies in hemophilia, you know, the first of which is not yet on the market. But the exciting thing about the project is that we're working with, you know, eight companies that have these gene therapy treatments in various stages of development. And what everyone has expressed at least a strong desire to be able to do when the project is done is to use the core set of outcomes that emerge from the project, you know, as the primary and secondary outcomes in their in each company's pivotal trials. And we believe that will have a huge value in terms of then payers and formulary committees and organizations like ICER and others that work on value-based pricing will actually have a kind of a predetermined set of outcomes to work with that are the same across all the products and for which we have direct input from patients and clinicians and payers in advance that these are the outcomes that are most meaningful.
Now, the Green Park Collaborative and CMTP are not regulatory bodies, so the guidelines that you all are working on and issuing, what force do they have? They don't have the force of law or even of a regulation. Are they just guidelines that people can choose to follow or not follow?
Yeah, they are guidelines that folks can choose to follow and not follow. There's no sort of regulatory enforcement. To some degree, as you know, regulatory guidance documents are also advisory and not mandatory. So the reason that you do or don't follow those is, you know, you have to make judgments about how it might impact the likelihood of, you know, a positive regulatory decision if you decide you have another approach you'd prefer to pursue. But technically, you're not legally obligated to follow the guidance. And I think the same basic logic would argue that if we go through a robust process to get input from patients and payers and the key decision makers who are going to be influencing market access for these products, and there's a set of recommendations out there that they all participated in developing, they'd have to generally have a pretty strong idea about why it would be preferable to do it some different way. And probably be ready to explain that to, you know, HTA groups and payers when their products come up for review.
Until 2005, you were the chief medical officer at CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which provides health coverage to over 100 million Americans. In the 12 years since you left CMS, drug prices, of course, have become a hot topic in the U.S. and many other countries. So CMS recently announced that they would adopt an outcomes-based payment approach to the newly FDA-approved CAR-T gene therapy for a form of pediatric leukemia. Can you describe this payment arrangement and what the implications might be for future policy approaches by CMS and commercial payers in the U.S.?
Well, this policy by CMS has, obviously the basic policy is that they've adopted some version of what's a pretty familiar outcomes-based agreement. And at least my understanding is that this payment for the drug would only be limited to those patients who have a response within 1 month. And What's not out there in the trade press or hasn't been shared by either CMS or Novartis is the details of you know, what trigger, what, you know, what qualifies as a response and how long it has to be maintained. In a sense, the notion or the basic concept in this outcomes-based agreement is similar to things that we've heard being done in an ad hoc form previously, both in the U.S. and abroad. What's kind of taken everybody by surprise with this CMS policy is no one who has yet written about this can quite figure out what legal authorities Medicare was using to be able to implement this. And it's sort of incompatible with all of the known pricing mechanisms for, you know, for drugs that CMS has been using in the past. So there's a whole lot of uncertainty and curiosity about how it actually came to be. And that, by the way, includes people in the, you know, in the Office of the Secretary and the Department of Health and people on Capitol Hill. And so it's fair to say, at least in my opinion, that there is some possibility that actually implementing this agreement is going to be trickier than, you know, that it just looks based on the announcement. And that's in part just because so much of how Medicare establishes the prices and reimbursement for drugs is really precisely defined in statute and regulation. And this approach that was adopted in this case doesn't look like it was based on any of those historical mechanisms.
But then let me ask you, is CMS obligated or not to disclose the details of this arrangement under freedom of information or other statutes? And secondly, could this arrangement be challenged?
I can't think of any prior example where CMS has not provided a clear explanation based on their sort of existing laws and regulations for why they made a policy they made. You know, I think their basic administrative procedures don't allow, you know, executive agencies to just issue policies that are not consistent with, right, all of their existing rules and precedents for that matter. The other piece of this is that whatever one's existing authorities are, our authorities are, if you're a public executive agency, if you do something dramatically different with the same authorities, usually there's a requirement that that would go through a regulatory development process, notice and comment rulemaking, so that it can be sort of, you know, rationally developed with lots of input from stakeholders. And obviously that didn't happen in this case. As to whether it could be challenged, you know, that's based on two things. One is, you know, did they in fact violate any of their existing authorities? And the other is, does anybody see it in their interest to challenge them? You know, sometimes things get done that are novel, but there's no stakeholder that feels that somehow their position is enhanced by implementing a legal challenge, and so those may not happen.
But again, you wouldn't expect CMS to publish the details of the arrangement?
No, to
the general public?
I would expect that will happen. And there's been a letter from Congress with a whole long list of questions about exactly how the policy came about that I would assume CMS will be obligated to provide answers to those questions on a reasonable time frame.
Moving to the public debate about drug pricing in the U.S., in your opinion, what are some important misconceptions in this debate, and what would you say to clear them up?
My personal opinion is that the work that's being done, you know, in the space of, you know, of drug pricing, particularly some of the value-based pricing, indication-specific pricing, some of the novel ideas that are now being considered, you know, are really important steps forward. And I think they've provoked exactly the right kind of, you know, push and shove and debate, you know, that is going to be helpful going forward. I'd say the biggest misconception or issue, at least that I see, is that whatever people think about, you know, just the quality of the economic models underlying the value-based prices that are being offered, the models are in fact pretty sophisticated. What I think is harder to understand from my perspective is, to what degree is that value-based price in any way supposed to be close to or related to what is a kind of an economically viable price from a drug developer perspective or from an industry perspective? I just think that there's a big gap between what's the value-based price and what the health system actually ought to pay for something. I don't think those are necessarily the same two things. And part of the difference being, you know, what is actually going to be an adequate potential future reward for the development of these new products to make it likely that there will continue to be new drugs further down the road. So I guess that's the piece of that seems to me the least discussed is how are these value-based prices supposed to be translated into the actual prices of the health system paying for the drugs.
And what about from the patient perspective, the question of affordability and families having to be out of pocket for medicines they may need, which may be out of their price range? Has that debate been robust enough, clear enough, or are there some misconceptions there as well?
Yeah, about what the patient cost sharing is related to highly expensive drugs?
Right. When patients are financially unable to afford drugs that are too expensive for their pocketbook, has that discussion occurred sufficiently in the right way? Are there any misconceptions in that space as well?
No, I think it's a very important and complicated space on its own. Of course, as there's lots of programs that pharmaceutical companies and nonprofit organizations have to try to make it possible to pay for expensive drugs when, people really don't have the financial resources. And of course, at least under the existing versions of the Affordable Care Act, assuming they don't get changed too dramatically, there are definitely kind of strong income triggers that would provide enough assistance, I think, for many of these drugs to get paid for. However, at the end of the day, I still think that particularly for middle income and even getting into upper income individuals, the benefit structure now around some of these drugs are that the co-pays themselves can be tens of thousands of dollars that, are not paid for by insurance and just come out of people's pockets, which is pretty enormous burden, on individuals. So yeah, I think there's a whole set of things there. And I guess the part of the drug pricing debate that I've been most, and most people have been kind of plugged into is the side of it, which is, what really does constitute a value-based price or a reasonable price or a fair price for a drug. And then there's that whole other side of the debate, which is no matter what that is, and even if it's considered reasonable, fair, or value-based, it still may be enormously expensive.
Let's turn to the FDA for a moment. In a recent speech, the FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, described several initiatives such as combined phase or seamless trials, master protocols, predictive algorithms, focused on reducing drug development costs and timelines, and maybe ultimately reducing drug prices. Now, drug prices generally are considered industry's problem, if you will, but can regulatory agencies like the FDA help bring prices down? And if so, how would they do that?
I think all of the ones that you listed have the potential to reduce drug development costs, and in theory, those savings could be passed on in the form of lower drug prices. Particularly some of the things about more efficient trials and maybe even some of this work that's being done to introduce more use of real-world data and real-world evidence in drug development, getting rid of some of the kind of end-arounds related to generic competition as well. I guess what's a slight disconnect in all of that is that if we're really shifting towards this idea that we should be paying for drugs primarily based on their clinical benefits or tied to their clinical benefits and their value, that's really a different concept than, making the cost of developing the drugs cheaper, because that's not supposed to be in a value-based system. That's not supposed to be a major factor in how you price the drugs to begin with. So maybe in some way it's still over time, would help to kind of draw some of the resources out of the drug development system. But again, I feel like the direction of flow with policy around drug pricing isn't about how much it costs or to develop them or how much risk is involved. It's about what they actually contribute to patient care and future savings and complications avoided, et cetera.
If I understand your answer correctly, it seems that the commissioner's assumption that reducing drug development costs will translate into lower drug prices is an assumption that may not be borne out, because value-based pricing would be a more important consideration. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my view on this. I think it just seems to me like the policy world has moved away from the idea that the costs of drug development that have been and should continue to be the a significant determinant in the price that's set for those drugs, that price, it doesn't matter how long it took or how much it cost or how much risk there was, at the end of the day, you know, the health system wants to purchase things based on what their value is to the system. It's like we wouldn't be paying twice, we wouldn't think we should pay twice as much for iPhones if it suddenly costs, you know, twice as much, you know, to build them. That's up to the people who are building the iPhones. You know, we want to be paying a price that we think the finished product is worth.
If I could make a school analogy, it doesn't matter how hard the student studied for an exam. What matters is, are the answers on the exam correct?
Yeah.
Is that
a
fit analogy, essentially? It doesn't matter how hard the industry worked on a drug, does the drug work, essentially?
I think that's right. It's not to say that it would not also be important to find ways to increase the efficiency of drug development. Like, all of that makes complete sense. So the whole enterprise could hopefully be, less expensive, less resource intensive, et cetera. As I said, if the policy shift now is to say we really want to tie the prices of these drugs to how well they work, that has nothing to do with how easy it was to run the trials.
Finally, there is now proposed legislation in the U.S. Congress that would potentially turn CMS into the single provider of health coverage for all Americans, similar in many ways to what many other countries have put in place. As a former CMS official, what is your perspective on this possibility? Would this be a practical solution, and what would it actually solve, if anything?
I think the idea has of obvious benefits in terms of some, you know, huge potential one-time cost savings, or not one-time, actually ongoing cost savings, particularly in the administrative costs area. You know, all the money that goes into, you know, in the commercial insurance system and, you know, advertising and, you know, the kind of the billing and claims processing. And, you know, a lot of that is done really, really efficiently in the context of the Medicare program. So administrative simplification, which some people say is 20% of health spending or some pretty big numbers, you know, right? In theory, that gets significantly reduced in a single payer context. To me, and there's probably long ways to answer this, but I personally am a big fan of health systems like the NHS. And I think, you know, fundamentally single payer systems can provide extremely good quality of care and not, you know, enormous issues with, you know, restrictions on access to certain kinds of products or, you know, wait lists or any of those sorts of things. But the single payer system, I think, will inevitably come with some of the features of a government health system that, you know, U.S. citizens, I think, have expressed a lot of concerns and hesitation around. Anything that looks like potential barriers to care, limitations to choices, limitations to providers, right? All those things that I think could easily come along with a single payer system as a way of, you know, managing costs in that context, it, you know, people aren't going to be happy about. I think it's being presented as, you know, a nirvana that has none of the, you know, we don't have to ration healthcare. There'll be plenty of much, whatever you need. You'll have open access to specialists, you know, it's kind of, and it will cost less. You know, that's just a fantasy.
Well, the debate will no doubt continue, and we'll leave it at that. That's our time today. I want to thank you very much for your insights today, Sean. Appreciate you speaking with us at the Global Forum.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thanks. Nice talking to you.
For the AA Global Forum, I'm Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.